As test kits become more available and as more people test positive for COVID-19, we're hearing more about what to do and what not to do. Be prepared, but there are mixed messages. Use masks, don't buy masks. We talked to Kaiser's chief of infectious disease, Dr. Collis, last week about what Kaiser Permanente has been doing to prepare its staff and patients. He sets the stage explaining the difference between an epidemic and a pandemic.
So an epidemic in general refers to a sudden increase in the number of cases of a given disease above what is normally seen. Outbreak and epidemic are largely the same in common parlance. A pandemic, on the other hand, usually refers to an epidemic that has spread over several countries or continents, affecting, you know, a lot larger numbers of people. I think it's a bit, you know, as Tony Fauci from the NIH pointed out recently, it's a bit of a semantic thing. It's a bit of a squishy definition as to what constitutes a formal pandemic. The World Health Organization has their own definition, which requires not just multiple continents, but also measures the degree of impact on those continents. Other people feel, hey, we've already sort of met the pandemic sort of definition as things are right now. So I think it doesn't change too much on the ground, but I think, you know, when you look broadly, we're certainly dealing with several countries, many countries, an increasing number affected with ongoing spread, and that's, you know, that's the situation we're in. Whether you call that multiple epidemics or a pandemic, is a bit of a semantic issue at this point.
They just sound so scary, and you know, there's got to be some, I guess, balance, because you don't want people to be hysterical about something, but you do want them to be cognizant of, you know, what's at risk.
Yes, no, I think that's very true, and I think, you know, one thing about us as a society, or maybe even as a species, is that we tend to be very afraid of things that we don't know much about, and lose perspective relative to things that are very familiar to us, but which are quite dangerous. I mean, we're in the middle of a very busy flu season. Influenza has killed something like 16,000 people in the U.S. this year, just this flu season, and always kills somewhere between 20 and 60,000 people in any given year. And yet we don't, you know, there's not a lot of uproar in national press around flu, even though it's a far deadlier thing for this country currently than coronavirus. So I do think that perspective is a hard thing to maintain, but I do think, you know, it's worth keeping in mind that we're not quite sure what we're dealing with yet, but we have the broad parameters of it and how much of a challenge this will be for us to manage outside of a situation like China, which has a very different public health infrastructure and a very different level of acute care than we can provide here. Remains to be seen, but I think staying up at night worrying about it and following the news with a huge ton of concern is not really going to be super productive for any given individual. Let's just trust that things will be okay, and at the same time prepare adequately on an individual level and a healthcare level for whatever it's going to be.
You talk about the flu. So how are we doing this flu season here in Hawaii?
It's a really busy one. It's been quite one of the busier ones in recent years we've seen here, certainly in the last several weeks. The Hawaii levels of flu have climbed steadily. They've actually been above the national average for the past several weeks, which is unusual. We tend to lag behind the mainland U.S., but in recent weeks we've actually come a little bit ahead of the U.S. in terms of the number of influenza-like illnesses and confirmed flus we're dealing with per capita. So it's been busy. Our hospital and Queens have taken a somewhat unusual step of now screening folks as they come through the door for temperature and flu-like symptoms. And again, that's really based on flu, not coronavirus, although it may help for that down the road. But that's a reflection of the fact that we've certainly had a lot of flu-related illnesses in our members, and actually a lot of doctors and nurses becoming quite ill with flu, too. So we're trying to do our best to protect our staff and our members by limiting the number of visitors to our facility right now.
Do we have a sense on the numbers of, you know, people who have died here in Hawaii because of the flu this season?
No, I don't think those are. Those are usually tracked retrospectively, and it takes a while to accrue all those numbers for lots of different reasons. It's just it's hard to attribute given deaths to flu in real time. So I don't have those numbers in front of me, and we usually find that out closer to the end of the season or even in the year following.
So maybe, though, if there is one positive thing because of the concern about the COVID-19, that maybe people who might have resisted getting the flu shot figured, oh, well, I better go get this if it's going to, you know, help me, you know, survive flu season just from the regular flu.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we've certainly been encouraging folks to get flu shots really aggressively, as has, I think, really the Department of Health. And that's not because, by the way, the flu vaccine protects you against coronavirus. They're very different viruses structurally. But because for your own health in a busy flu season, it's important, and certainly going forward, minimizing the amount of flu we have in the community as we're trying to sort out who may have flu, who may have coronaviruses. Those two infections overlap a lot in their clinical presentation. Obviously, the less flu we have, the less confusing it is, and the better care we can provide as a, you know, as a healthcare organization.
Now, I've been battling, you know, losing my voice this past week, and, you know, everybody's joking like, oh, gosh, don't give me the coronavirus. But, you know, because we don't know at this point, right? I mean, we don't have the test kits.
Yes, I think, you know, certainly as a state, but really as a country, we've been hobbled a lot in our capacity to really test appropriately for coronavirus because of our of the difficulties with getting a test kit that's functional. That's really not something that's done at a local level. That the CDC has really struggled to have a test kit for us that's very workable. There are many other countries that are testing far more aggressively than the U.S. I think the South Korea has done over 30,000 tests for flu. We've done, I think, for coronavirus, we've done less than 500 that I'm aware of in this country. South Korea has been able to roll out drive-through clinics, which is pretty brilliant. The U.K. is planning to do that as well. But we really can't move forward as a state or country until we have a more appropriate test kit availability and hopefully commercial lab availability for us to be able to test broad numbers of patients quickly and triage them effectively. So we're certainly a little behind on that as a country, and I'm hoping we catch up soon.
And it might be one thing to jump up and down and say we need those test kits, but if they're not, you know, the right test kits to use, if they're defective in any way, it's kind of pointless to roll them out.
Yes, no, I mean, I think, you know, to keep things in perspective, I think part of the reason that that there's such tough controls around testing for infectious diseases in this country is that they really believe at a state and public health and CDC level that the quality of the tests that we use have to be accurate if we're going to take care of people appropriately. So there's a lot of quality control that goes into designating a test as ready for prime time, and that does slow us down, and hopefully it ensures for good quality when we finally have a kit that's usable.
And we have heard from the state health department, you know, saying that the CDC had certain guidelines about, you know, who gets tested, and we understand they've, you know, adjusted some of those guidelines. But the CDC says be prepared. Our risk is low still, but be prepared. But, you know, I think there are a lot of people out there that just don't really know what that means.
Yeah, I mean, it's a super fluid situation, obviously. And you know, I guess I would put this in perspective a little bit. This is the third, you know, major outbreak since the turn of the century of this particular group of coronaviruses, what we call beta coronaviruses or group 2B coronaviruses. You know, the first was in 2003 when SARS emerged out of China. The second was in 2012. With the Middle East Respiratory Syndrome coronavirus, which emerged in Saudi Arabia. And this one, 7 years later, which began in late 2019, is the third. And each of those has been very different, but these are three viruses that are really very closely related to one another. We did learn a lot, luckily, from the first two, but what we're realizing with the current coronavirus is that it's much less deadly, certainly, than either SARS or MERS, like far, far less deadly. So on an individual level, that's great. However, from a overall healthcare standpoint, it's a little bit trickier because it becomes much more like the cold or the flu, in that it spreads easily. People can spread the infection without quite knowing that they have something that could be serious to others, and so it presents a lot bigger challenge. And it is harder to anticipate what's coming. I think, you know, those of us in the infectious disease community are actively planning for a lot of different possibilities. This could be something as mild as simply a bad cold or flu season. I think there's a real possibility of that. This could also be something in which we're dealing with a situation where a subset of the population, especially the elderly or those with immunocompromising conditions or other conditions affecting their heart and lungs, where a large segment of that population who's susceptible to this infection becomes quite ill, and there's a challenge for the healthcare system as a whole in terms of caring for large numbers of people with bad pneumonia. And I think anywhere in between those is certainly possible as well. But we're actively, as an organization at Kaiser, and I know the Healthcare Association of Hawaii and the Department of Health EPI branch are all preparing for any one of those possibilities with contingency plannings and triage planning that stem out from how things play out on the ground in the coming months. It is hard to anticipate, but I think, you know, I would want people to know that actively those of us who are in the thick of this thing are planning for any number of different scenarios, including ones that might be quite mild, and that would be awesome if that's what it turns out to be. But if it's more severe than that, there's a lot of heavy planning going on for other eventualities as well.
So what types of, I guess, questions are you getting from your members, you know, when they come into your clinics and your hospitals around this virus?
Yeah, I think many. We're getting a lot of travel-related questions, understandably. We do get a lot of questions as to sort of like what is our overall level of readiness as a hospital and a healthcare facility. And I think that those are more than fair, and I'm glad people are asking that. One of the good things, you know, just to address that up front, one of the good things that emerged from the Ebola epidemic in 2014 was that our hospital, Kaiser Mamala Hospital, was designated an Ebola assessment facility, and so we were actively preparing for the presence of Ebola on the island. And thank goodness that didn't happen, but we really realized in the process that we should maintain that same level of readiness for other emerging infectious diseases, because it was inevitable that we deal with something like this. This is the nature of the current world we live in, where everything is so interconnected. And so we've been doing quarterly training for the last 5 years for emerging infections, and we've recently focused those towards coronavirus. We had a large-scale drill yesterday in which we simulated a patient showing up to a Kaiser facility needing to be transported to the hospital, dealt in real time on the ground with sort of like what it's like to care for that patient, make sure their family members are safe, make sure that the other members in the clinic and the hospital are safe, make sure that the healthcare workers are well taken care of as they prepare for this. And we'll be doing a lot more of that going forward, because I think there's nothing like drills to really get you in the right mindset for caring for folks. We're doing a lot of stuff in terms of supply management, which is really important. That sounds kind of boring, but you really have to know in gory detail how many, not just face masks and face shields you have, but antibiotics. Antibiotics are, China is a major supplier of antibiotics for the world. And we very early on made sure that we have a large supply of antibiotics on hand, not so much for coronavirus, but just in case there's disruptions in the supply chain. And then, you know, we're doing a lot of work with the state EPI branch, as well as the Healthcare Association of Hawaii, and we're tied into national partners within Kaiser. We're lucky to be part of an organization that's quite tied into the California experience, where a lot of our Kaiser colleagues there are helping the state of California and the federal government in caring for the many patients with COVID and in California. We're learning a lot from them on the ground. So there's a lot going on kind of quietly behind the scenes, and a lot of active planning that I think should be reassuring to folks, because yes, it's a fluid situation, but there's a lot of bright minds on top of it.
Well, I know as we see the headlines, you know, there's a lot of focus on the number of confirmed cases. Mm-hmm. But I'm almost wondering if, you know, we should maybe not look at that so much and look at more at the fatality rate.
Yeah, I mean, I think one thing to just put out there is that, you know, having infections in general, infectious diseases in general, outbreaks in general, early on we tend to overestimate the mortality rate significantly, and that's because the testing capacity is not up to speed, as is certainly the case now, and because many mild cases therefore go undetected. So the denominator, as it were, is actually a lot larger than we're generally seeing. That's certainly the case if you look in China, where the healthcare facilities are quite overwhelmed, as is their testing capacity. So many people are simply not getting tested, or they're just recovering at home, or they give up waiting in the emergency room and they go home simply to recover at home. And so the number of actual infections out there seems lower than it is, but you obviously count the fatalities, so that the fatality rate looks much higher. We're obviously in the process of really trying to get a good sense from the China experience. There was an excellent paper published in mid-February that looked at the first 72,000 cases. This is published in a Chinese epidemiology journal and co-sponsored by the CDC out there. So it's good data. And it really showed very clearly that about 80% of infections, and again, this is probably an underestimate, but at least 80% of infections with coronavirus are quite mild, folks that don't really need much health care, if any at all. And that really the groups we need to be most concerned about helping with this infection, should they get it, are those who are elderly, especially those who are over 80, but certainly in an age-dependent fashion. This virus, as was the case, by the way, with both SARS and MERS-related coronaviruses from prior years, those are also very age-dependent infections. If you're young and healthy, certainly if you're younger than 40, this virus likely poses a minimal threat to your health. But if you're older than 60, 65, 70, or if you have significant heart and lung disease, those are the folks that we're going to need to be really concerned about with this infection. And so we're learning a lot from the Chinese experience. And yes, I agree that that focusing on fatality rate at this point is only minimally useful because the data are very incomplete. It's often only after epidemics are sort of in their waning phases and we're starting to collect blood from people who may not even have had symptoms that we get a much more accurate case count of what we're dealing with and a much better estimate of how deadly things are. But at least we know the group that we'll need to be focusing on to help them stay healthy in the future.
What do you say to people who are, you know, watching TV, reading the newspaper, reading articles online, and they're just confused by the messages?
Yeah, it's tough. I guess I push a couple of points. One is the issue of trying to maintain perspective, as we talked about, and put this in the context of other things we deal with regularly, like flu. This in its heart of hearts, this virus may turn out to be some variant of a very bad cold or flu virus that's particularly harsh on the elderly. And that just may be what this is. And worrying about it overly is not going to change the outcome of things. We talked about the flu shot, which I think is important. I do talk to people and my patients in some detail about maintaining their own health in a general sense. I mean, I think, if nothing else, washing your hands as often as possible. By the way, hand washing is probably more effective than alcohol, gels, et cetera, is a good habit to get into in general, but especially during respiratory seasons, whether or not coronavirus is circulating. There's a lot of things that affect our immune system that we sort of take for granted. Sleeping well, eating well, watching your stress levels, maintaining your social relationships. These are actually really important and really can help protect you from any number of different infections. And that's really important to keep in mind. The state has recently emphasized the importance of the emergency preparedness kits that we're all supposed to have for hurricane season, of keeping those in hand for coronavirus and making sure that you have food and medical supplies and extra chronic medicines on hand. And that's not because, by the way, that the state expects things to shut down and for people not to be able to get the services they need. But in general, there are probably going to be a good subset of people, if this strikes in a major way in the community, who are going to need to stay at home and probably recover at home and try to limit their exposure to others to keep others safe. And so for that reason, having some degree of emergency preparedness, I think, is a great idea, living on an island anyhow. But certainly in this setting, I think that's probably prudent for the general health.
I'm just curious. I don't know what got you into the infectious disease area, but, you know, when you come across something like this and everybody kind of springs into action, I guess, you know, what are you thinking?
Well, this is what we signed up for, right? This is why I like the field. I mean, there's always something new and different in infectious diseases. Every few years, something comes flying out of the forest or the, you know, seafood market or what have you and catches us by surprise as a specialty. And that's super cool. It's neat to be constantly learning and having to react and think on your feet. And it's, people often ask, like, wow, is that scary? You know, we deal with flesh-eating bacteria and tuberculosis and all these other things. And I feel like an incredible blessing to do what we do. It's really neat to be challenged at work and trying to help folks. I mean, the vast majority of what I deal with infectious diseases, you know, I can fix, which is awesome. Most of the people I take care of, I can help get better. And that's not always the case in every medical specialty. And so it's super gratifying. So frankly, you know, I'm tired, but I love it.
Was there an infectious disease that just got you, like, you know, into pursuing this?
You know, no, it was really that at the places that I did most of my training at Cornell Medical School and in University of Pennsylvania for residency, those were two hotbeds for really great infectious disease docs. And so a lot of my heroes when I was a medical student and resident were all in this field. I thought they were the coolest, brightest guys in the room, and they seemed to really enjoy what they did, and there was a big international flavor to the work that they did, mm-hmm. which appealed to me. I'm a first-generation American, and both my parents are from other parts of the world, and I like that international part to it. So, it was just that the best docs I knew were in this field, and I really admired them, so I wanted to be like that.
And that was Dr. Tarkan Collis, Chief of Infectious Disease at Kaiser Permanente Hawaii.